Well, let's shift on to initiative two, which focuses on the brain. What are the temporal dynamics of brain cells, brain systems, and behavior? How do these dynamics change with learning, and how do they influence learning? And I think Howard Poisner is the point person on this.
So I think our discussions were fairly grandiose, but I was very pleased by the fact that people felt that there was realistic possibilities of integrating across quite a variety of these levels that people were working at, from the cellular up through spacing learning at days. So our initiative is focused on the brain and is focused more on learning as opposed to sequence structure and representation. But we had really some parallel integration thoughts. So one thing that we felt was crucial and in fact possible was to be able to study learning cross-species, cross-modal, and cross-temporal level, and be able to integrate those. As I say, it sounds very grandiose, but there were some concrete suggestions. Mu-Ping in particular, I thought, had some very great ideas as to how that might be done. So, for example, how does spike timing dependent plasticity happen? Not just in a dish, as it's typically studied, but in context, in learning, and in behavior. So how might one go about being able to bridge that cellular up through behavioral scale? EEG, again, was suggested as one possibility. And in order to do that, we also felt that we need to understand the origin of the EEG much better. And there are bridges that could be made. One ECOG, electrocorticogram, that is actually an intermediate form of recording in the human brain prior to surgery, where you can simultaneously record cells and cortical EEG, and to see what the sources of the EEG might be, and then back chain. Back to earlier levels. So Ken Harris, for example, was studying something just above spike timing dependent plasticity in terms of sensory responsiveness and going through the fact that there are up and down states and these waves that are very intrinsic brain waves that are very relevant to our taking in information and learning information. Once we get to brain waves, we can see how cortical EEG, if we understood its origins, might be very relevant. And then in terms of spike timing dependent plasticity, Young and Mu-Ping look not only at these fine millisecond timing differences, but look at them in relation to these cortical waves, these slow waves. So we felt that there might actually be realistic and non-long-term ways to begin projects to link across these levels. And another suggested set of experiments that might link animal and human behavior, there was a large discussion about how spacing effects are very critical in learning, certainly at the behavioral level. And then Mu-Ping also said that in their experiments, they showed that spacing effects can be very critical at the cellular level too, in terms of the precise spacing of external pulses that are used in eliciting spike timing dependent plasticity and the washout of long-term potentiation over repeated learning session. In their cases, the spacing effects were very prominent if you had like 5-minute intervals, but the intervals were critical, and they also found that the long-term potentiation was very much dependent upon the spacing regimen. And there were a variety of other suggestions in terms of cross-modal integration, cross-species, Jenny Dessau, I know, is very involved in that with respect to human behavior, auditory visual cross-modal integration. And again, I don't mean to pick on Mu Ping here, but he had some great suggestions and was suggesting that in superior colliculus, there are maps that integrate auditory and visual information. And then if you had an animal model of some of these processes that were going on that you were studying at the human behavioral level, you could get towards the mechanism. So we felt that, I thought it was a very exciting discussion, and we felt that there were realistic ways in which future experiments could now be discussed and planned and generated to be able to look cross-modal, cross-species, cross-time scale. We felt that EEG was going to be an important component of a bridge, and we needed to understand the sources of the EEG better, but that that would be possible through a number of techniques. And that, in fact, we didn't come up with concrete suggestions for how to implement some of these very interesting suggestions, but we felt that they were realistic.
Mu Ming.
Oh, I'm sorry.
It's only a few milliseconds difference.
Well, maybe Mu Ming, could you just say a word or two about any of the above? Would you mind?
Done on a human level, psychophysical level, actually provide a guide for experiments at a cellular circuit level. For example, this interesting sensory cross-modal interactions, you can do that in animal, in experiments, and also you can look for areas, one region, how is mentioned, the colliculus, which has single cells responding both to auditory and visual information. They converge on the same cell. They have dendritic integration triggers spikes that triggers spike time independent plasticity. So you have a cross-modal interaction right at a cellular level that are spike time independent. So what one can imagine that there could be parallel human experiments on transfer of memories from one modality to another that could be tested in animal models to find out exactly how the timing plays a role in this learning processes. Now, it is parallel. It's probably analogy, but maybe eventually this is really the basis for higher level function. So I think there are these both ways. You can go from animal experiments to think about doing psychophysics experiment to test whether the phenomenon you find in the animal. For example, there's one experiment which I talk a little bit about the interval timing, memory of interval timing at a seconds level, which you can see these waves or cortical, actually tactile neuronal activities which can be entrained by visual stimulus of certain interval. And that, after the conditioning, you can see reverberation of the activity at the same interval as the conditioning. And that, one can imagine, might reflect on a higher perceptual level. In fact, in animal experiment we have done with zebrafish, the waves in the tectum, the reverberating wave in tectum corresponds to the escape behavior of the tadpole. One can condition, use some visual conditioning to trigger waves in the tectum, and that visual conditioning also triggers behavioral response, reverberating behavioral response. So one can then imagine these low animal experiments might eventually reflect on the learning at a higher level. And a reverse situation could be one can learn a lot of things from psychophysics, and then do experiment in animals. I think that's one of the advantage. I think participating in this type of network activity would help both the experimental and the model and the cognitive sciences.
Terry, do you have anything on that?
So to follow up on the tectum or superior colliculus in mammals, it's well known that it's a structure, it's important, obviously, for orienting, both in terms of moving the eyes, but also the neck and the body. And recently, Rich Krauslis, who's a colleague of mine at the Salk Institute, has shown that it's also has a very interesting relationship to attention. And that's, of course, something that is very important for children who are having trouble with focusing. And I don't think anybody's really looked at that. I mean, most people sort of think of this as kind of higher sort of cortical level, but the parietal cortex and the tectum really talk to each other. And so it could be that there's something to be learned by looking more carefully at the superior colliculus.
So I'd like to pose a challenge, and it's not just about this particular project, but kind of cuts across all the initiatives. Is, you know, as ideas like this are generated, how do they live beyond this meeting, right? And that can be in the context of network meetings. It can be in the context of other meetings. But as the challenge, it's if there really are, you know, ideas like this that really cut across different levels and different labs and different groups, to put it upon people to try to make it happen. And it can be done inexpensively, right? I mean, a meeting is great, but we don't have a lot of money for that. But you can do things online. We can get things with streaming video. There's a lot of ways to make this work. Even if, as a starting point, it's just a morning. You know, a few hours, people getting together. And so as these ideas germinate, I mean, that's what it means to be a center, is to make these things happen. And so we need to do that.
Paula?
Well, I had committed to try to put a meeting together at the Santa Fe Institute, because I'm on their scientific board, and one of our responsibilities is to put a meeting together. And I already, just before you said that, was writing down a list, because I think this is a perfect topic. That is, every time we talk at these meetings and at other meetings that relate to these kinds of topics, what we do end up with is, you know, some very interesting ideas and very interesting data at the level of long-term potentiation and depression, for example, and then we end up with these phenomena of, you know, sequencing problems in various clinical and populations, or how they might drive normal development in language, and everyone goes, wow, you know, there seems to be some common elements, but how would you ever get to that? And so I think one of the themes across all of these meetings, and that's already the progress of having this center, is that people are saying, a lot of people say, well, you'll never get to that. And I think that what we're saying is we could at least have a real intense discussion about what kinds of information and what kinds of technologies would have to be in place before we could ask questions about the trajectories in the nervous system, about temporal coding. So I think that I will pledge, at this point, to try to put a meeting together to further this discussion and try to get that funded by the Santa Fe Institute. So hopefully it doesn't cost the center money. And Terry already said I was doing that, so I was quite surprised to see that I was putting a meeting together in 2008 at the Santa Fe Institute, so I'm now saying, okay, I'll do that. I can't promise it'll be 2008. I'll try.
So that's one bid from Paul. Any raise on that? Anybody want to? Ginny, do you want to say anything on this?
I guess besides EEG and related techniques, another important technique that might be able to bring together the cellular work and the more behavioral level work is modeling. And we can make models about how those things happen and go together and do that in conjunction with the EEG and some of the empirical techniques and try to make progress that way.
Just plug for the fact that if we really, really think carefully about our behaviors in terms of what could be translated to a level that could be evaluated across these different domains, and then really synchronize, as Andrea always says, try to really synchronize the details of those behavioral tasks. Behavior will play as much of a role as the electrophysiology and the modeling. I think we have to be just as, have just as much of a basic science of the kinds of ways we ask questions about behavior as we do in all these other levels.
We're actually moving along fairly quickly. If what I'd like to do possibly is even see if we can get the four initiatives all dealt with before the break, and at that point perhaps the caffeine will have kicked in, and then you'll have some more questions. And also the modelling issue I think is going to come up, and it came up yesterday in several of the groups, and I think there's a sort of a philosophical level discussion, also a practical level discussion there that needs to be had about modelling. So Javier, when you've maybe you could do movement and exploration, now your report on three, initiative three. Gary's doing that one.
Okay, so the initiative three had two breakout sessions. I was only at one of them, as planned. So there were two breakouts or breaks out. Okay, I'll just leave it this way. And the interesting thing it seemed for us to discuss was that the initiative seemed to be combining things that were like apples and oranges. There's, you know, it's motor control and information gathering. So all of the things that say information gathering turn out to be about mostly about salience and eye movements. Go away. And so what does moving our hands and interesting things and images have to do with one another? So we decided that these two things were joined at the hip, so as to speak, or maybe at the eye sockets, that they really are two issues in optimal control. So both involve exploration and exploitation. Deciding where to look and when to move are really optimal control problems. But they have really different sets of costs. Moving your eyes has a low cost. Moving your arms generally has a higher cost. The reward structure is quite different for moving your eyes. And moving your touching somebody is quite different than just looking at them. And they have to be coordinated in order to optimize long-term expected reward. So in bridging the hand-eye gap, you need to learn to coordinate your hands and your eyes, and this involves the temporal dynamics of perceiving, learning, and acting. And we thought that the best way to encapsulate this idea was with the question, how do you pour tea? Or for this group, how do you pour Kool-Aid? And, you know, you shouldn't be looking at your hand when you're pouring tea. That would be the wrong place to look. You need to look at the spout and the cup. That's where the action is. It's not, your hand. So it involves prediction, anticipated change, a top-down interest in a particular kind of change, and I am making this change in what I'm looking at happen. Another way to think about it is... I am the agent of change as I am seeing as I type this. Okay. But I don't think we should completely ignore the differences between the hands and the eyes. I mean, we just listed some of the differences, but we need to explore those. Dan Bubb's shown that motor representations are activated by visual representations of manipulable objects only if we intend to grasp those objects. But it doesn't seem to be the case with looking at faces, for example. So we think that motor representations of facial expressions are activated by the visual stimuli alone through the mirror neuron system. And so, you know, assuming that this is like everything else. And so the question is, could, you know, seeing things this way provide some additional avenue to explore in thinking about training persons with autism who presumably have a poor mirror neuron system, as Joe McCleary has shown. Could we use this to, you know, they're treating faces like objects. Maybe if we could think of some way they can manipulate them. We had some interesting controversies. I have a model of salience that has obvious bottom-up and top-down components in the right side of Bayes' rule, but Mike Moser doesn't believe in this distinction between top-down and bottom-up, but they're just terms in my equation. what's Mike's problem? But he's right. I mean, there isn't a bottom-up pass followed by a top-down pass. Neurons are already activated before the input comes in, and can we resolve the differences between our views on this? And I think, you know, this is putting together some words. It's not really an idea, but I think we need something like a couple differential Bayesian equations that are mediating between levels of representation. So they're dynamic, they're different, you know, they're continuous, they're doing the Bayes thing. So I also have a suggestion for a new... get new laptops. That would be one. So this is it. Okay. So this isn't a joke. This is my last slide. So this involves, now Andrea starts out saying, you know, the brain is a giant oscillator, right? Here, this whole situation involves a bunch of oscillators up on the stage. They're coordinating their activities with one another to synchronize, not their research in this case, but their actions. They're oscillating, they're creating temporal oscillations in the music, and they're coordinating with one another. We're out there, coupled oscillators with what they're doing, and in this situation, we're just doing it, whatever our particular motions are. We have very different ways in which we're entrained by the music. But this is, you know, that's a natural one, but you can also train people to dance, and there are experts, and there are non-experts, like me. I just, you know, I know what I like, I just aren't very good at it. But there's somebody who is good at it. I think we'd really, I mean, this is, for me, this is low-hanging fruit, you know, trying to understand the dynamics of of these kinds of interactions between music, people acting, people creating the music is just crying out for somebody to work on this. And part of what I think we need is somebody is more dynamicist, somebody on the order of a Guggenheimer, or somebody and. I think that we're also doing things like, I don't know if you heard what he's saying, but... maybe this isn't the one, but there's one where he's saying, say hell, hell, say hell. And, you know, so there's symbolic dynamics as well. So I think, you know, Devaney... would be a good guy to have as well as a Guggenheimer, not just the differential equation guys, but the symbolic dynamics guys. So I think that we should be, you know, this is fun to do, but it's also, I think, something we should be doing. I really think this involves all of the stuff that the center's interested in. So. Temporal dynamics of behavior, where you have all these dyads, people dancing with each other, or triads, and how do those play out? So that's my report on Initiative 3.
One of the programs that we're planning for doing next year, by the way, is... at the Science Network is the musical brain, and I've already spoken to Peter Janitor and a few other people about this. It seems to me that music is one of the subjects that, if you've got any ideas afterwards, music is one of the subjects that seems to me would be an absolute natural for this kind of a center. So I'd be love to hear any ideas from you on that. But Javier, do you have a mic over there? Would you